Accession number 16673, real one.
Mr. Aylard, real one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in London.
Which part of London?
In Highgate.
Which year was this?
1920.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a schoolteacher.
Did you go to school in Highgate?
No, I was lived all my young days in Southgate.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
I was 18.
So this was just before the war started?
That's right.
Did you get a job?
No, I went on to the London School of Economics, and I stayed there for 1 year from September 38 to July 39. But in May 39, I had joined the London division of the RNBR, so that 2 days after war started, I was called up and went to HMS Victory in Portsmouth.
Why had you joined the Volunteer Reserve?
Because I wanted to be in the Navy, and I knew that unless I'd got into a reserve of that force, I would very likely be asked to go into the Army or the Air Force, which I didn't find very attractive.
Was it easy to get in?
I did have a little assistance in that I was told where to write to get an interview, and that seemed to be successful because I was enrolled immediately and started training 2 nights a week at the HMS President moored in the Thames.
Did you learn very much before you were
called? I learned enough to put the uniform on and not to make a complete fool of myself if I went on board one of HM ships, but the time available between May and September is not really enough to get a proper grounding.
And after your call-up, you went to...?
I went immediately to the barracks in Portsmouth at the signal school, as it had been decided that I should become a coder, and one had to learn how to use the naval code, which was really quite straightforward, but it had to be done very accurately, obviously. And I and another 30-odd ratings were trained in this coding, and we were then allocated almost en bloc to various armed merchant cruisers which were fitting out at that time in various parts of the country. The first three in the alphabet were sent to HMS Jervis Bay, and the second three were sent to HMS Royal Pindy, both of which were fitting out in the London docks and were tied up on opposite side of the King George V dock. The captain of HMS Royal Pindy was Ludovic Kennedy's father, and the captain at that time of the Jervis Bay was a Captain Harris, later to be replaced a couple of months on by Captain Fogarty Fegan, who became very famous a year later, when the ship was in action with the Admiral Scheer.
And you went to the Jervis Bay?
And I went to the Jervis Bay.
What impression did the ship make on you at first?
Well, it was very strange, of course, coming from civilian life at the age of 19 into a ship which was manned very largely by a few RNVR ratings of my own age. But the bulk of the crew was made up of RFR, Royal Fleet Reserve ratings, who had served a lifetime in the Royal Navy, mainly in peacetime, but whom were obviously most highly trained and very valuable people as far as the Navy was concerned. And they were very valuable to the RNVR because, of course, they taught us a tremendous amount. And we fitted in initially with a little difficulty because of the great differences in age. But there were some members of the RFR who were very outgoing sort of people and who made our assimilation into the crew a very easy matter. And I can always remember one leading seaman of the next mess to ours, who was leading seaman, his name escapes me at the moment, but he had just recently come back to the ship, having been a conductor on a London bus, a very cheerful Cockney, and a man of whom I had very great respect, because he was so helpful in showing us the way around the ship and how to accept naval discipline. The ship, of course, was a much larger place than one had ever lived in, and a very different place, having to sleep in a hammock, eating and sleeping in the same area on the mess deck, which set out in a way which I was reminded when I went to see the Warrior at Portsmouth, which dated back into the previous century, with the mess table against the ship's side and the hammocks above the mess table and all the items of gear that you used for receiving food from the galley. These things appeared not to have changed very much from the time of the Warrior. However, that was perfectly acceptable and clean and moderately comfortable. And then we set to sea, and of course that naturally was a bit of an experience, but one soon got used to it, and fortunately I didn't suffer from seasickness very much. We then made our way to Scapa Flow, and after Christmas of the 1939, we were sent out to Freetown in Africa and carried out convoy duties between Freetown and the approaches to the Channel. We always came back near to England, but we were based first of all in Freetown, then in Bermuda, and later in Halifax. And it was from this port that the Jervis Bay sailed on her last trip in October 1940, because she was sunk on November the 5th, 1940, halfway back to England with HX 84. There was very considerable loss of life on the Jervis Bay, and she was outgunned very dramatically by the German ship, and there were very heavy casualties. Fortunately, a small merchant ship in the convoy decided to return to the scene of the action after all the other ships had left very hastily, as one would expect. She came back to see whether there were any survivors, and this was an absolutely wonderful action, because of course the loss of life would have been much greater if she hadn't returned. So I'm very glad to say that I did later meet my old comrades, but I and a dozen RNVR ratings had left the ship in September 1940 in order to return to the UK to see whether we were capable of undertaking a course to achieve a commission in the Navy.
Karen.
Fortunately, I was able to pass the tests and became a temporary acting sub-lieutenant RNVR on the 22nd of January 1941.
You were telling me earlier off the record about the painting of the ship, Jervis Bay during the war, if you could repeat what you were telling me earlier.
Yes. When I joined the ship in London Docks, she was then painted dark grey, dark Admiralty grey. In other words, she was painted as a warship would be painted, and she bore this livery until we came back to Newcastle after having, as I had mentioned, visited Scapa Flow. And at that occasion, she then was returned to her normal colours as a ship of the Aberdeen and Commonwealth line, which had a yellow buff funnel, white upperworks, and a dark green hull. I've always understood that this arrangement of painting was in order that she didn't immediately become recognisable as a warship. In other words, if a German submarine saw the ship, she could be distracted and assume that it was a merchant ship. This obviously wouldn't give her any great protection, but it might at least ensure that she wasn't immediately singled out if she was in a convoy. This point about the livery hasn't always been understood, because pictures have appeared since the war, and in which case the Jarvis Bay always appears to be carrying the naval livery.
Did you, were you telling me that our museum had got it wrong?
I wouldn't like to be absolutely categorical about it, but I have a feeling that it should be painted in the house colours and not in navy grey.
How did you feel about being posted to an armed merchant cruiser?
I was very naive. I didn't know a great deal about things, and it was just another ship as far as I was concerned. But of course, as soon as I entered the mess deck, all the RFR personnel were very apprehensive of having to go to sea in a ship which was not armoured in any way, and she just had the normal construction of a merchant ship, which of course is not designed to absorb any great punishment, and there's a lot of woodwork in the ship which could cause extensive fires, and of course she was fitted out with very ancient guns which had done service in the 1914-18 war, and although they were perfectly satisfactory as guns, they were not designed to fire accurately or of sufficient range to take on any form of German warship worthy of the name. However, the idea was that she would be able to fight a similarly converted German raider. The Germans put ships to sea which were merchant ships and armed, in a similar way to the Jarvis Bay. In other words, they carried naval guns, but they carried much better naval guns, and their guns were disguised, so that if you came across a German raider at sea, all you could see was apparently an innocent merchant ship. And it has been the case that warships have approached such German ships too close without proper awareness of the danger, and have been overwhelmed by German gunfire. In other words, if the Jarvis Bay had had to meet a German raider, she would have been hard put to win the day. And there were occasions where British armed merchant cruisers, such as, I believe, Carnarvon Castle, encountered a German raider and didn't do very well. In other words, the ratings, the Royal Fleet Reserve ratings, told us that we could have a very risky career if we ever met up with a German warship of any consequence. And of course, this is exactly what happened. In fact, the RFR people had a nickname for the ships, which was Admiralty Made Coffins, because AMC, Armed Merchant Cruiser, was the official title. But the men who'd been to sea in warships all their life soon realised the shortcomings of the using AMCs, and this fact was realised possibly 12 months, 18 months down the line, where so many of the AMCs were sunk, many by submarines, that it became very obvious that the British merchant fleet was going to be decimated and that a lot of ships would be lost, which were later to be very urgently required for other purposes, such as troop ships. So when possibly upwards of a dozen or more AMCs had been lost by submarine, the policy of using them for convoy and escort purposes was stopped, and they assumed a different guise as troop ships, and one or two other purposes. But AMCs, in other words, had a rather short life, and a not very pleasant one for many of the crews.
Did you get to know the captain at all?
Employed on decoding and coding British signals using the Admiralty Code, had to work in the former wireless office of the Jarvis Bay, which meant that I shared the office with a Marconi operator. Merchant ships before the war carried wireless operators who were fully trained by the Marconi Company, and they had become temporary Royal Naval personnel. At times it was necessary, having heard the signal being received by Morse by the operator, to then take it, decode it and take it then to the bridge. And there were occasions when I had to take the signal to the captain's cabin, and possibly other occasions when he was talking with other officers on the bridge. So I did actually see and speak to the captain, and that was rather a privilege, of course, because it isn't every rating that can go up to the captain or have a reason for going to the captain. Naturally, he didn't carry on any conversation with me, but it's very nice now to realise exactly that I did meet this illustrious officer.
Is this Fogarty Fegan?
This is Captain Fogarty Fegan. He had had a distinguished career in the Navy, and we were lucky that he was appointed to Jervis Bay.
Anything you can say about him as a man?
Well, he was a very approachable and genial person who, although he carried the highest rank in the ship, he was not above passing a small joke, or at least conveying the normal civilities of life in a very graceful way. He was not the outspoken, barking, shouting sort of character. He was a very graceful and pleasant individual. He was, after all, of Irish extraction, and it showed.
Any anecdotes about him?
No, I'm afraid not. I only had very fleeting glances of him, glimpses of him, and I really had no way of hearing of any stories from about him. I think I wasn't his confidant, or I had little to do with the officers generally. If I spoke to a chief petty officer, I think that was about my limit in normal circumstances. All I can say is that he was highly thought of by the ship's company, and that people felt that if there was a possibility of the ship surviving, then Captain Fegan was the person most likely to see that the ship's company were given the best chance in any action.
Any stories about the Jervis Bay itself whilst you were in it?
The Jervis Bay had a rather checkered career in its early days, because there has been a book written on the subject, and the first captain didn't have a great deal of luck, and on one occasion we had a collision. We were we went up to Scapa Flow, and we seemed to have problems with the engines, because of course the whole way of organising the ship was different. She wasn't going on long voyages. She was required to stay at anchor for long periods and so on in Scapa Flow until she was required for duty. In other words, there were sort of teething troubles from switching from a merchant ship routine to a naval routine, and we had to come from Scapa Flow down to the Tyne for repairs. And en route, we went into the Firth of Forth, and in the fog and darkness, she collided with a destroyer. I think it was the Scimitar. Only a small destroyer and only a small collision, but it caused the Royal Fleet Reserve ratings to consider that this would never have happened on a proper Navy ship. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know, but we had to go to the Tyne for repairs, and from there we went to down to Portsmouth for the Christmas period in 1939. We spent Christmas Day anchored in the fog off Portsmouth Harbour, anchored in Portsmouth Harbour. And from there we sailed to Freetown, and that was the last time the ship and many of the ship's company were ever to come back to the UK, of course. We arrived in North Africa, in West Africa, early in January, and then spent the whole of the next 9 months on convoy duty in the Atlantic, both from Freetown and also from Bermuda and from Halifax.
Was your time with the Jervis Bay pleasant or unpleasant?
It was pleasant. They were jovial, hospitable people on board. It was a good atmosphere on the ship. But I did find the change from civilian life to the Navy a bit of a challenge, and I took a while to settle down, but having spent a couple of months on the ship, I became very much at home, and you felt that you'd actually been on the ship for a lot longer than in point of fact.
What happened to you when you left the ship?
Well, in September 1940, I was put ashore in Halifax to await transport back to the UK, and at that time Churchill had been negotiating with Roosevelt for the 50 lend-lease destroyers. These were very ancient American four-funnel destroyers which dated back to the First World War and had formed part of the American Naval Reserve. We allowed the Americans to have use of bases in the West Indies for a period of, I think it was 50 years, and in return we were allowed to take these rather elderly and delicate American destroyers back to the UK and to fit them up with British armament and British facilities in other respects, so that they could be used as escort destroyers, which was something we were very short of at that time. I joined this, what was then a completely American-style ship, as part of the crew, to come back to the UK in order to go through the assessment process to see whether I was capable of taking a commission in the Navy. And, of course, that again was a bit of a change because everything was different. We didn't have hammocks, we had bunks. And there were many other differences about the ship. It was a much, much smaller ship, of course, than the Jervis Bay. It was very mobile and volatile. One had to sort of grab hold of everything in order to be sure that you didn't fall over as you or was carried away when you were on deck. One got used to that quite quickly, because I spent the rest of the war in small ships. But it was an initiation process of getting across the Atlantic in this strange ship.
Do you remember its name?
Yes, the ship was the HMS, we called it HMS Bradford. I think the American name was McLanahan, but that obviously one could check up quite easily. We had a fairly quiet passage across the Atlantic, and I ended up in Devonport, where I then went on leave for a short period and later was transferred to HMS King Alfred, which was the name given to the naval training base in Hove. And before the war, it had formed the Hove swimming baths. The baths were all boarded over, and we were trained in the hall, which obviously had formed part of the sort of swimming area, and also in the car park. It was a time when everything was done rather hastily and best use made of what was available. Although it wasn't an ideal set of circumstances, it worked, and after a 3 month period I was passed out as a temporary acting sub-lieutenant.
Just coming back to the Bradford, what yes. condition was it in?
Well, the ship was in perfectly seaworthy condition, but it hadn't been manned or in use for many years, and of course defects immediately became apparent, and all the American town class, as they were called, because that was the name the British gave them, they were all named after ships in Great Britain, the towns in Great Britain, and they were found to be in not terribly good state of repair, and not only had they to be made really seaworthy for use day in and day out on long voyages across the Atlantic, but they had to have British equipment because you couldn't have recourse to American stores. Clearly they had to be part of the British Navy and had to have British equipment. So it took some time before they were fully fighting fit to go out with a British convoy force and assume the full role that they were required to undertake.
What defects did you notice?
Well, I can't recall anything specific, but I have read subsequently about this, and many of the ships spent a lot of time once they had come to the UK. They spent the time in dock. Others that were rather extensively rebuilt by the Navy managed to put up a good impression. But they were a mixed bunch, and they served a turn at a very very awkward time. But I think the late Navy was quite glad to see them pensioned off, as they were possibly during the late 1940s.
So, you become an officer. What happened to you then?
Well, I was immediately then posted to a ship in... I think I joined the ship in Belfast. It was a Grimsby trawler, large Grimsby trawler, which had been taken from fishing duty and converted to anti-submarine escort, fitted with ASDIC and the 4-inch gun and... at that stage Lewis guns, but later Oerlikons, in order to form part of the convoy escorts in the same way that the American destroyer formed part of a convoy escort. The trawler was a much better buy from the Navy point of view, because she was exceedingly robust and a very good ship at sea. In other words, she was very steady and could take the most extreme weather without any hardship. The American ships were delicate and subject to damage at sea in storms, whereas I joined this ship, which was the Ayrshire, and she was so robust that we went through a storm in winter of 1942, which was an extreme weather off the coast, southwest coast of Iceland, and it was force 12, which is as high as you can go on the Beaufort scale, a really tremendous storm, and we were in an awkward position because not only was the weather extreme, but we were in a very risky area, which is the southwest corner of Iceland. Now, in those days, we didn't have radar, and all we had was access to a direction-finding beacon, which was sighted on the south coast of Iceland. And it was only formed one point. In other words, you could tell whether you were left of this station or right of it, but you couldn't tell how far away you were. If there had been two stations, one could have taken a bearing from each of the two and found where they crossed, and that gave you a position. But at that time, there was just one station on the southwest coast of Iceland, and we had approached that area from the UK, and with very stormy weather, it's not easy to find out where you are. In other words, if you can't see the sun and you can't see the stars, you can't get sights, and you can only assume that you have gone so many miles in a certain time, because you know how fast the ship's been going, or you have an idea how fast the ship's been going, and you know which course you've been going, but you don't know whether you've been swept left, right, or back. And consequently, we approached the southwest corner of Iceland, not knowing precisely where we were. And in this area, there are numerous small islands and reefs, which are not marked in any way. And consequently,